Figuring out what Jay Powell means when he says stuff. I mean, how hard can that be? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday today, the 29th day of March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We are going to do a little news you can use up at the top of the program today. Information that's going to be handy in navigating the macroeconomic conversation the next couple of months. And it comes to us, the news you can use does, in the person of one Jerome Powell.
We aim to use our tools to moderate demand growth, thereby facilitating continued sustainable increases in employment and wages.
That was Chair Powell at that conference on Monday last week that we've talked about a couple of times since. The one where he said in almost this many words, yeah, sure, we might raise interest rates half a percentage point next time. And that much we all get, right? Raising rates a half a percent. But that line about tools, which he uses all the time, by the way, what is up with that? Nina Ihacker is an assistant professor of economics at the University of Rhode Island, and we have gotten her on the phone to talk Jay Powell and the Fed's tools. Professor, thanks for coming on.
It's great to be here.
So these tools of which Jay Powell speaks, which we just heard, layman's terms, what are they?
Broadly speaking, they all refer in some way or another to making it easier, which is to say less costly, for banks to borrow, or harder, which is to say more costly, for them to do business. So when the Fed engages in expansionary actions, it uses one of any number of programs to directly or indirectly decrease rates. Mm-hmm. And if it wants to slow activity, it uses any number of measures to make interest rates higher, with the understanding that higher rates likely curb borrowing, right, which likely curbs economic activity, which can slow price increases.
Terrific. Continue with the layman's terms mantra here. And you said any one of a number of methods, right? So the ultimate tool is interest rates. Behind the scenes, mm-hmm, what kind of dials and levers are Jay and the gang at the Fed pulling and pushing?
Broadly speaking, the Federal Reserve can purchase bonds and other financial assets that private creditors or private investors may hold. So the classic example from a macro class is the Federal Reserve decides to buy $200,000 worth of U.S. government bonds. By purchasing that bond, the Fed effectively is putting $200,000 mm-hmm into circulation.
The Federal Reserve, as you and I and regular listeners to this program know, has what's called a dual mandate, right? Stable prices, mm-hmm, and maximum employment. The Fed, by using all of the tools of which Mr. Powell and others are so fond of speaking, they can't actually directly affect either one of those two things, can they, right? They have to do their tool, use their tools, and then wait and see what happens.
That's correct. All of this activity relies on the other institution at the end of the transaction. It relies on whatever is happening with the bank or with the private bondholder. If we think about expansionary measures, the question is, one, will banks lend? And the second question is, will firms borrow? And then even the third question could be, will firms borrow with the intent to use those funds, right, to hire more workers?
Right.
Or will they use those funds for some other purpose that's unrelated to employment?
Right. Following on to that, that last bit of that question, there are broad swaths of the population who are farther downstream from what the Fed does. And obviously, I'm thinking here of lower income and minority Americans who it takes a while for the Fed's actions to get to them, both in a positive and, I suppose, a negative sense.
That's correct. And Powell himself has talked about the fact that aggregate unemployment rates don't tell enough about what is happening at the farther reaches of demographic groups, what is happening with African-American unemployment rates, what is happening with unemployment rates outside of cities and other areas with very fast economic growth or that recovered more quickly from the crisis.
All right, so I'm going to take you off script here. Not that this is scripted, to be clear. I'm going to take you off script, though, and ask you about the Fed for the rest of this year, right? Because you observe this in a professional capacity and you observe it as a participant in this economy. Is the Fed's use of its tools going to be enough to control the inflation that we're also worried about?
That is the $64,000 yes, question.
Well, you get the big money to answer these, so you know.
So, what I believe is that Powell will respond to the challenges of the crisis of the economy at large. Ultimately, I think that Powell is clear enough, even though he says that the buck stops with the Fed to end inflation. I think that if we really want to see changes in inflation, the imperative is going to come from the government to spend in a more tailored fashion, whether that is to encourage more employment of groups that have not fared as well in the recovery, or to stimulate growth in areas of the economy that could plausibly lead to a decrease in overall costs that are underlying current inflation.
Nina Eihacker is an assistant professor of economics up at the University of Rhode Island. Professor, thanks for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
On Wall Street today, it was green. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Every time I use the phrase the law of supply and demand on this program, I get a couple economists emailing me saying, hey, it's not a law, Kai. It's a model or a theory. So let's try this, shall we, to set up Lily Jamali on this next story. You want to see a real-life application of the theory of supply and demand? Look no farther than this morning's Case-Shiller Home Price Index. Nationally, prices in January up more than 19% from a year ago. Here's Lily with the housing supply demand model.
The supply of homes available in the U.S. right now is just really, really low, says Jonathan Miller, president and CEO of Miller Samuel Real Estate Appraisers. To put that in perspective, he paints this scenario.
If you pick a typical town or neighborhood, and let's call the normal level of inventory is 200.
As in 200 homes for sale.
And then last year it fell to 50. And so everybody's saying, wow, inventory's really dropped. Now it's 8, where there's an utter collapse.
The National Association of Realtors says total housing inventory in February nationwide was 870,000. And Redfin chief economist Daryl Fairweather says its numbers show inventory is down 23% from last year.
It was at an all-time low in the last 4 weeks.
One big reason?
People were rushing to buy homes while mortgage rates were still low.
But now interest rates are rising. Earlier this month, mortgage rates rose above 4% for the first time since 2019. And Fairweather says that should cool the housing market.
And I think that's actually a good thing.
But National Association of Realtors chief economist Lawrence Yoon says that doesn't solve the inventory problem.
It's not going to fix itself in short times, even with mortgage rates inching up.
Yoon says between rising rates and rising prices, buyers could end up paying 40% more for a mortgage on the same house today compared to a year ago. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
There are, give or take, 26 million people living in Shanghai, which means there are, give or take, 13 million people locked down this week. The other 13 million people are going to be locked down next week. as China's financial center tries to control a COVID outbreak. Yesterday, Shanghai accounted for about half, about 3,500 or so, of all of the COVID cases in China. And that 7,000 in the aggregate might sound like relatively nothing. We're averaging 28,000 cases a day here. But when Beijing's COVID strategy nationwide is zero tolerance, 7,000 is a lot. Shanghai has been sealing up different neighborhoods for shorter lockdowns the past couple of weeks. Dynamic clearance is the name of that policy, meant to be less economically disruptive than full city lockdowns, which sounds great. But as Marketplace's Jennifer Pack explains, living through it, that's a whole nother thing.
The first time my building was under a lockdown, it wasn't even called a lockdown. Instead, we were under a, quote, closed-loop management, which meant two COVID tests in 2 days at the library. A cotton swab, two quick swirls in my mouth, and the PCR test was done. Shanghai is mass testing block by block. Enforcement varies. Some friends can't even go past their front door, while I'm still allowed to go grocery shopping. There's a decent selection at my supermarket. Shanghai officials say there is no need to panic buy, but good luck getting delivery. Friends have been trying for days. Day two may sound like a social event, but it's another PCR test. The lockdown is supposed to last 48 hours, but that's in name only. On day three, Friday, I wait and wait. Until 11 p.m., I hear a noise outside my window.
The lockdown continues tomorrow. There will be a second round of PCRs. Please plan accordingly for tomorrow.
Things could be a lot worse. The high-tech hub of Shenzhen says it had lifted a 7-day citywide lockdown. But a video circulating online says at least one area was still sealed off after almost 3 weeks. Residents lined the gates of their compound and shouted, "Lift the lockdown!" Another video that went viral showed a man breaking down when he was not allowed to work. "I'm not endangering society," he says to policemen. "I want to live. I need to support my family. Do you want me to die?" He slaps his hands on both sides of his head over and over. COVID is taking its toll on people. And China's aggressive strategy against COVID is partly because of her. There are still 52 million elderly who are not fully vaccinated. Mass testing is one way to catch infections before they spread. Day five, fourth PCR test, this time under heavy rain.
They just swabbed our mouths and put a bunch of the samples into the same tube. And if someone in there tests positive, then they pick those 10 and do a more detailed PCR for each of them. That's how China has been able to mass test tens of millions of people within a matter of days.
If you test positive for COVID, the consequences are the same across China. Not only do you get quarantined in a government-assigned hotel, but also your contacts and your contacts' contacts. Meantime, in low-risk areas like where Marketplace's news assistant Charles Zhang is, life is somewhat normal.
I'm standing outside a sealed apartment building in my apartment complex. Even though this building is less than 100 meters away from my apartment building, I'm still free to leave this apartment complex.
And yet, when the same thing happens, a building two doors down from me has been sealed off, a very different reaction. Two men in hazmat suits say, "I can't leave the compound anymore." It's now day seven. So children play hide-and-go-seek to pass the time. Then, just before dinner, a knock on my door. The lockdown is lifted, says my building management. Less than a week later, another announcement. We'll be locked down again in a few days' time. In Shanghai, working from home, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
Coming up,
young women's educational advantages are starting to pay off.
And that is good news. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 338 today, nearly 1%, 35,294. The NASDAQ packed on 264 points, about 1.8%, 14,619. The S&P 500 picked up 56 points, about 1.2%, 46.31. FedEx lifted 3.7% today after news that its CEO and founder would step down. Fred Smith started the Memphis-based company more than 50 years ago. The FDA, might have heard this, has authorized second boosters of two vaccines for people 50 and older. The news comes as Europe is going through another wave of this virus. Today, Pfizer down 1%. Moderna gained about 4.3%. Bond prices were up. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell. Get this, fell to 2.39%. And you are listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. As of yesterday, according to the United Nations, just over 3.9 million people have left Ukraine trying to get away from the war. They have gone to Romania and Hungary, Slovakia as well, but overwhelmingly 2.3 million of that 3.9 million, they have gone to Poland. The government in Warsaw has authorized almost $2 billion to support him, but as Marketplace's Sabri Benishul reports, Poles themselves have decided that is not enough and are chipping in to help.
When Russia began invading Ukraine, 75-year-old Alla Mikhno was in bed.
It was exactly at 4 a.m. when she woke up to this horrific noise of sirens.
This is Alla's granddaughter, Emilia Komarova, translating for her.
5 nights in a row, when the sirens were going on, they were all running to metro. And because metro is now like a hiding place, it's like a bomb shelter.
When not in the subway, Alla would sleep in her bathtub. Emilia watched all this unfold on TV from Washington, D.C. Sometimes she would reach her grandmother on the phone, finding her sitting on the concrete floor of the subway station, surrounded by huddled families.
She was all by herself, and it's very heartbreaking because only in moments like this you like understand, you know, that like you should have spent more time with her. You should have like appreciated time with your grandma more, like your grandparents and family in general.
Across the border in Poland, Emilia had an old college classmate from American University, Patrick Cervoni. Like so many Poles, he was trying to find some way to help the streams of refugees from Ukraine.
I texted every friend that came to mind, not even friend, but even, you know, people I didn't really know well. And I offered the possibility to stay at our family house.
He reached out to Emilia on Facebook, and the timing was lucky. Her septuagenarian grandmother was then threading her way to the Polish border. A group of Ukrainians in Latvia had organized an evacuation bus, and her neighbors put her on it.
You have 40 minutes to pack your stuff, and then we're leaving.
The bus spent 24 hours at the border, but got through, and Patrick was there with a car to take Alla to his family home in Kanchuga, Poland. Her daughter and son-in-law were there, too. They had been traveling when the war broke out and also found their way to Patrick's house, where he tried to make them feel at home.
She could not even, like, mention everything that he has done because he has done so much. He took them to various stores. He showed, like, specific places where you can get discounted food or like free food specifically for Ukrainians who, you know, who don't have money with them or have like low budget because of everything.
He took them to pizzerias, gave them a tour of a medieval castle, basically just tried to distract them from the 24/7 news coverage of destruction back home. And Patrick was far from the only one in this small town trying to help. Everyone from grocers to bus drivers pitched in.
When drivers see passports, like Ukrainian passports, like nobody's asking any questions, you know, so it's free for Ukrainians.
I mean, it's a very small town of 3,000 inhabitants. However, it has turned into, each of these towns has really turned into an area of, you know, welcoming refugees and offering everything people could to, you know, help and make people feel at home.
A kindergarten opened up spots for Ukrainian kids. A cooking club made meals. People set up fundraisers. The Polish government is offering financial aid to households who take in refugees and is allowing Ukrainians to work for the next year and a half. At the border, Alla got a free SIM card for her phone. There were donated clothes and toys. Ukrainians can get debit cards with an allowance each month and access to health care.
She wants people to understand that Polish people are incredibly supportive, and they're doing everything to make people's sufferings easier.
Aside from that, Alla Michno just wants to go home to a country not at war. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace. $11.3 million is the marketplace macroeconomic number of the day. That is denominated in job openings in this economy as of the end of February, basically the same number as January. So we learned from this morning's job openings and labor turnover survey, JOLTS for the cool kids. As has been the case for months now, there's a whole lot of turnover going on. Millions of people quitting jobs, taking new ones, often for better pay. And that brings us to this. The Pew Research Center says that the past couple of years in a number of cities around the country, the gender pay gap for younger full-time workers, to be clear, has all but disappeared. Marketplace's Samantha Fields has that one.
In 22 cities around the country, including New York and D.C., women under 30 who work full-time are earning as much or more than men.
Young women, in terms of sort of their educational attainment, are markedly outpacing young men.
Richard Fry at Pew Research says the fact that more women have college degrees than men is likely a big factor here.
Young women's educational advantages are starting to pay off.
But in more than 200 metro areas Pew had data for, women under 30 working full-time still earn less than men. And even in the places where younger women have reached parity, it doesn't last.
The gender wage gap grows as workers age.
Elise Gould is with the Economic Policy Institute.
Then we know that there is a motherhood penalty for women who decide to become mothers.
And that wage gap only widens as women get older. Sarah Small at the Center for Women and Work at Rutgers says the data highlights something the pandemic also made clear.
When you maybe don't have children to care for, you have all these opportunities to make gains in your career. But once we have children, those inequities really start to build.
And are even larger for women of color and for women without college degrees.
It's an encouraging study to see that in a lot of major cities, you know, the gender wage gap is closing.
But Small says the fact that it's only happening for younger full-time workers in a select few areas shows that there's still a long way to go. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, you know all those ratings and demographics and media measurements that Nielsen does? Do you have any sense of how much they're worth as a business proposition, I mean? Yeah, $16 billion is how much. Nielsen Holdings has agreed to a private equity buyout in the aforementioned amount. That'll give them, in theory, the money they need to get up to speed in the streaming age. Nielsen's been kind of behind the curve on that for a while now. All right, we got to go. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. We started with a lesson about the Fed's tools. We're going to end with a lesson about the bond market, specifically the yield curve, and what part of it being, for a brief moment today, inverted might mean. Normally, the yield curve slopes up and to the right. Time to maturity on the horizontal axis, interest rate on the vertical axis, right? Put that in your mind. So you can see that the government has to pay you more to borrow your money for a longer term. That's what happens when you buy a bond, right? You are lending the government money. So the government has to pay you more interest on a, I don't know, a 10-year note than it does when you buy a 2-year note. Well, today, for a relative nanosecond, the 210 curve inverted. Twos were paying more interest than tens. Now, why am I telling you this and not just mercifully ending the program right now? Because inverted yield curves can, and I repeat, can be a sign of recession to come, but not like tomorrow. But when you hear inverted yield curve, that's what that means. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Siobhan Brett, Dylan Mietinen, Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.